Okay. Consideration of discussion. We have a report on the presentation on liberal arts degrees. Is Gary going to get us started on that? Gary. Okay. So this is something I've been looking forward to. I think the board has been looking forward to it. So we'll start with a presentation here, and then we're going to go to Q&A. I want to we're going to let the board fully engage, but if there's folks in the audience when we get into the dialogue and then they have burning questions and we have time, we'll let folks weigh in here. So I want this to be very interactive. I think we're all going to learn from this. So, Gary.
Thank you. I'm here in my bureaucratic role to present the report that you as a board asked for with regard to the liberal arts and their value in creating critical and critical thinking, communication, and you asked for economic data. And my report is essentially this fine panel, and we appreciate the their agreement to talk with us and discuss the issue. Chancellor Gray Little will do a more formal introduction of the individuals who are presenting today at the front when she gives her remarks. I just want to make one brief comment on the employment and wage data that you have. You find on pages 62 to 64. I won't go into detail, but the point we would make is that graduates in the liberal arts do get work. And generally, they are recompensed for that work, albeit at the undergraduate level, perhaps somewhat below the level of their peers. Nonetheless, they do work and they do earn an income. But the fact that needs to be stressed is that many in the liberal arts continue with post-baccalaureate and or professional studies. If this room is to be taken as an example, I think many of them perhaps go into the legal profession. I'm not sure, but I think that might be the case. And I would refer you, if you haven't looked at it, Daniel Gordon's example, comparing marketing graduates with history graduates who have gone on to the latter, having gone on to graduate study. That graduate study sharply changes the economic landscape. So we just wanted to refer you to that information and see what you think about that. The foundational issue, and I think you'll hear a lot about that from our commenters, is the need for an education that will enable an individual to survive and prosper in a flexible workplace, one that in which much of work is being enhanced, if not replaced, by machines, putting a greater emphasis on creativity and ingenuity. And as we say in our report, the question is not whether there is value in the liberal arts. There is. That's a given, has been for centuries. The question is how and where to teach them in today's emerging marketplace where creativity and innovation, critical thought, these are all qualities to be nurtured. They're all markers of success. And I will now turn the podium over to Chancellor Gray Little and our commentators.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for scheduling this discussion. I think we have said in many ways over the last several months, if not the last few years, that this is a challenging time for universities, especially public universities, and that there are many issues that we need to tackle head on. Some of these revolve around the question of the mission of universities. What role do universities play in the life of states, nations, and the societies that we're in? And I think it was even mentioned yesterday that the notion of universities providing public good is at question, and that not so long ago that was taken for granted, but now we have to show that there is public benefit. We know, and as just was mentioned, that there is personal economic benefit for a college degree, including students who major in the humanities and social sciences and arts. But there are also a variety of other benefits related to health, lower crime rates, and other indicators that show the benefits of higher education. But the societal benefit goes beyond the earnings of individuals. We often think of the kind of citizens that we need for the society that we're in. A democracy needs educated, enlightened citizens and citizens who are engaged in their communities and in the political structure in their societies. Yet the public good, one of the aspirations that we've talked about, seems to take a back seat. And it is in many ways that the humanities, along with the arts and social sciences, are bearing the brunt of this change in value. Like art or music, the work created by our scholars can be appreciated for its own sake, and we recognize that in some instances. So we don't expect a composer or a conductor to do a cost-benefit analysis of their musical composition, and we don't especially think that it's efficient for one-minute waltz to be played in 30 seconds. That's not the kind of efficiency we want, and yet we begin to talk about education and performances in those areas as if that's the kind of indicator that we should use. Every major challenge that we face in our society, in the world, has a human dimension, and that human dimension is the subject of study and reflection in the arts and the humanities and the social sciences. And I'm just going to mention one recent example with Ebola, which is a health issue, and where we've talked about the desirability of vaccine. One of the reasons the situation with Ebola was so difficult is because of the notion of disease, the way people interpret what it means, and other things that would be studied in a thorough understanding of the culture of the people in those places. And so if we're going to have a full approach to addressing Ebola or other outbreaks in that place, we need the social sciences and the humanities. But this is challenging in an era when students and their parents especially are interested in qualifying the extrinsic value of degrees. It is often the focus on how can your education lead you to get a specific job. And that is understandable why that focus would be there, but I think it leads us to think of things in the short term. It was also mentioned that if we think about very important jobs in our society and industry and so on, that the kind of characteristics that are being looked for are the broad characteristics that people would learn from their education in the liberal arts and humanities. By contrast, when you go to look at hiring managers and personnel managers, they're often ticking off whether people have specific skills and background, but those skills and background are not the ones that are going to give them the characteristics to be the CEOs of those places. So we have all of these issues, the notion of what is the value of education, how does that lead to jobs, the concern that students and parents have about their occupations. And so I think it is time to take a few moments to talk about humanities, arts, and social sciences, to reflect on their importance and on how we can make the case for their value to parents, to students, to legislators, and to the society. And today, we have three panelists who are going to address these issues. First, Dave Cordell, who is provost at Emporia State, will address the diversity of university arts degrees and dispel some of the common misunderstandings about them. Then, Dandy Anderson, who's Dean of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Kansas, will discuss the value of majors in humanities and social and behavioral sciences. And then third, Chris Crawford, who's interim provost at Fort Hays, will review the importance of the liberal arts to non-liberal arts majors. And certainly you might have questions with each of these, and then we can have some time at the end. So, Dave.
Well, good morning. It's such a pleasure to be with you today. I'm going to be talking with you for just a few minutes about the arts as a subset of the liberal arts. Now, I think just about anyone who has even a passing awareness of our public colleges and universities would know that we teach the arts, music, art, theater, sometimes creative writing, maybe dance. But the actual role of the arts in the college curriculum is probably a lot more varied than people are aware of and that they realize. The reason for that is we teach the arts differently to different students for different reasons. For example, and bear with me here. I'm going to lead you into the weeds just a little bit. Undergraduate degree programs in the arts basically fall into three categories. First category, the true liberal arts program in an arts discipline. In this case, the degree is almost always a BA, Bachelor of Arts. Then the major, of course, might be in music or theater or art or what have you. Now, this kind of program usually only requires maybe 35, 40 hours in the actual arts discipline, which leaves a lot of room for students to do broad exploration. It leaves room for a double major, which many of them will elect to do. The purpose of this kind of program in this first category is not to train professional artists, musicians, and actors. The main purpose is to develop those transferable skills, as we often call them, communication skills, critical thinking, problem solving, but to develop those skills through the lens of music or art or theater or whatever the arts discipline might be. So in that respect, this kind of arts degree program functions very much like a major in history or a major in philosophy. It's not intended to be a direct line to any particular job or career. In fact, graduates from these programs end up doing all kinds of careers. So that's the first category. Now here's the second. Second category of undergraduate degree programs in the arts is the arts education program. The degree usually is titled something like Bachelor of Science in Education, although the designation can vary a little bit. Then again, the major would be in art or music or theater or what have you. Now, this is not really a liberal arts degree program. The reason I say that is its purpose, its specific purpose, is to train and certify the graduate to teach music or theater or art in the schools. That's what it's for. That's why the students do it. So this is very much a kind of program that is intended to be a direct line to a specific job and career. Now, here's the third kind of undergraduate degree program in the arts. I'm going to call this one the conservatory-type intensive program in an arts discipline. The degree is usually called Bachelor of Fine Arts, or if the major is music, it might more often have the designation Bachelor of Music. This kind of program requires a ton of hours in the arts discipline. It will definitely limit the student's ability to do broad exploration. In fact, double major is pretty much out of the question with this kind of program. Now, these are professional arts programs. They are not really liberal arts programs in any true sense of the word, because their main purpose is to train practitioners, professional musicians, professional artists, professional actors. I would still hesitate a little bit, though, to call this kind of program a direct line to a career. It might be more accurate to think of it as an entry ticket into a very competitive arena where there are a lot of other people who are trying hard to do the same thing you're trying to do. So basically, that's my summary of the three very different kinds of undergraduate arts degree programs. And of course, all three of those categories have their counterpart at the graduate level as well. Now, I think it's worth noting, though, that success in any of these degree programs pretty much requires the student to develop discipline, focus, problem-solving skills, communication skills. So in that respect, any and all of these programs contribute very directly to the student's acquisition of what in Foresight 2020 we call core skills. And those, of course, are the transferable skills that we believe students are going to need in the 21st century in order to have good lives, good careers, and in order to be good citizens in the communities where they live. I'm just going to point out in closing that, as I'm sure you know, many of our students study the arts not as a major at all, but as a part of their general education program. And also a lot of them study the arts on a purely elective basis. But the role of the arts in general education is really a different topic. And I think my colleague Chris Crawford is going to be addressing that in his remarks. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions for me at this time?
Regent Bennett.
So, Provost, are you majoring in music?
I did, yes.
So are you actually going to that, you're really in-depth with the music or just a transient?
Well, I have a recollection of being involved.
I know. That's what I'm asking.
But, you know, I'll answer.
You're very talented. So.
Thank you. But I'll answer your question a slightly different way. All the study I did in music, I use it every day because the skills developed are indeed transferable. And I guess really that's the main point that I wanted to make.
So Dave, fill in the discipline. So help me be able to explain. So if I'm getting a Bachelor of Arts in whatever the discipline versus a Bachelor of Science, how do you explain the difference in the two?
Actually, if you think of that question, you just take the arts, as I've been talking about them, out of the equation. What is the typical Bachelor of Arts constructed like compared to the Bachelor of Science? Typically, the Bachelor of Arts will have a heftier component of humanities. And foreign language would be one thing that you would immediately look for a significant chunk of requirements there. Okay,
and that's always the case. So that's whenever you see a BA, doesn't matter what the discipline is.
I would say just about always. Now, exactly how that's carried out from one university to another or college to another might vary, but that's pretty generally what you would expect to see with a Bachelor of Arts. By contrast, the Bachelor of Science, just like the name would suggest, you'll have you probably wouldn't see the same set of requirements for foreign language and other humanities. It would be scaled back considerably, and you would have a higher science content.
Other questions?
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I believe that you received an appointment this week, did you not?
I did.
I do yes. want to congratulate, I hope my colleagues know that Danny has been announced as the new president of Trinity University in San Antonio.
Yes, sir. Congratulations.
Just wanted to give you an additional credibility there before you start.
Well, that's with sweet sorrow because we certainly appreciate what you've done here. I know you've done an outstanding job, but we're happy for your new opportunity, and you will be missed.
Thank you very much. I will miss KU in Kansas. It has been a home for me for many, many years, and I'm looking forward to carrying the story about liberal arts in the 21st century in a new way. So it's a real pleasure to be here today and try and start a new version of that story. A few things that I would think about as you are trying to talk with others about what we do in liberal arts and sciences, I'm going to emphasize the idea of what it means if you're a major in the humanities or in the social sciences in my comments. But I'd ask you to step back and begin by just thinking about some of the terminology that we struggle with. When someone says liberal arts, one of the things that I would encourage you to remind people is that that includes math, sciences, chemistry, geology. Liberal arts is truly the broad phrase we want to use for everything. Within that, humanities and social sciences are two specific fields. And I think we have a lot of comfort socially with the varieties of opportunities and the real needs for individuals with backgrounds in sciences and math. And there's more question about what happens if you have a major in the humanities or a major in the social sciences. The second thing before I leap into some specifics is I would encourage you to think about the U.S. educational system and the whole concept of what a major is. You asked the question, the difference between a BA and a BS. A Bachelor of Arts is really the culmination of what we think of as liberal education. And I'm using not liberal arts, but liberal education. And I think the word that we often struggle around is liberal, especially at a time when we're a very polarized society. When you think about liberal arts or liberal education, I would encourage you to think about trade liberalization. How do you free an individual from regulation and constraint so that he or she could make choices in their life and move forward and be an active, participating citizen? That sense of being free to participate is where that liberating part of liberal arts or liberal education comes from, and it has nothing to do with political oppositions. And I think many people need to be reminded of that. So as you start talking about what people do, just to think about the majors. Humanities, some of the typical areas that people bring to mind would be history, literature, foreign languages. The phrase that Chancellor Graylittle used was talking about the human dimension. These are all fields that help us think about who are we? Where have we come from? Where are we going? How can we embody that history to understand? We're trying to gather that information, to put it together, to think about how can we use that to make choices as free individuals, and that it truly does help us sharpen our sense of our humanity and our appreciation of the humanities of others. The social sciences, I think, uses a very different approach. Rather than interpreting texts, which is very common in the humanities, the social sciences tend to look at individual behaviors, or they look at collective behaviors. They do a lot of either qualitative analysis based on interviews, or actually a lot of quantitative analysis, trying to help us think about what motivates individuals. Some of the things that are really important in the world today, if you listen to NPR this morning, there was an entire piece about why are millennials today choosing college careers. And it was using social science research to think about how can you quantify behavior and analyze it to understand what do young adults want when they are investing in a college degree. If you look at KU, some of the kinds of departments that are very typical would be economics, which is essential for thinking about all of the investment choices that we're making. Psychology, both for thinking about better individual lives, but also collectively, how would you work in a business, in an organization, to think about the motivation of your employees? Psychology is fundamental for answering those questions. The chancellor mentioned Ebola as one of the challenges we're facing today. At KU, one of our social science units is called Applied Behavioral Science. They have a project called the Community Toolbox, where they go and work with any community to think, how can you understand how you're organized? How are you addressing problems? How can we help you build capacity? They have been directly involved with countries in Africa to help them think about what are basic practices they can implement in terms of the ways that humans behave to help minimize and begin to help contain some of the threats of further contagion of Ebola. The social sciences are essential for not thinking about how does that infection work, but how do we help human beings make choices as free individuals about things they can do differently. I'm going to close. We were asked to be very brief with just a couple of comments. On the one hand, as you think about extrinsic value, and we're thinking about the different ways that salaries and the dollars can be approached looking at these different degrees, it's really important to look at the report. I think it does an excellent job of pointing out that there are many different metrics that we could use. One that I find especially valuable, there's a survey that's done by Gallup that is really trying to ask how socially, and this is a social science project, how can we rethink what it takes to increase productivity in the workplace. They use surveys, they analyze them, and rather than thinking about job satisfaction, what we have to think about is employee engagement. If you have employees who are more engaged, the productivity of your endeavor is going to be far increased. The same surveys also demonstrate that individuals with college degrees are far more engaged in the workplace than individuals who are not. They have all of those skills that the chancellor is describing, Dave Cordell was describing in terms of the transferable skills that really make a difference. Individuals are more creative. They can deal with complexity. They can think for themselves. They're able to work with others. And so that linkage between the dollars and the productivity and those true soft skills that come from having the background in the humanities, in the social sciences, in the ways that we can think about that, make a difference. I'm not going to repeat the many points that have been made about how that is important, but I would encourage you, as you think about how you defend the variety of majors we have, to think about the metaphor of an alloy and how it helps give us stronger metals. We need to have a true variety of perspectives and disciplines and backgrounds. When those come together, they help us bring new points of view that will strengthen everything that we're able to accomplish in any organization. So rather than having people ask, you know, what can you do with a liberal arts major, I would encourage you to ask them to reframe it and say, what can't you do? with a liberal arts major. Thank you.
Very good.
Are there questions now, or do you want to hear the...
I think we'll go ahead and finish the presentation, and we'll go to questions. So,
good morning.
Good morning.
Edgar Bronfman, former CEO of the Seagrins Corporation, provided great insight into the importance of liberal education for long-term success. He recently wrote, "Curiosity and openness to new ways of thinking, which is developed in learning about the world around you, the ability to critically analyze situations, nurtured every time we encounter a new argument or encountering the abstract that we deal with every time we experience art, music, theater, ensures future success more than any other quality." Those attributes of a liberal arts education, CEOs respect and find great value in for the long-term stability of their own corporations. Without question, liberal arts education advances these abilities with more efficacy than any other educational experience. This morning, I've chosen to focus my comments on two basic propositions. Proposition one, there are substantial internal and external threats which continue to undermine the goals of liberal arts education. The first battle really is waged every day across our campuses, namely negotiating the many competing institutional priorities that we have. I have a couple examples which may illustrate exactly what I perceive to be going on. Within the university environment, there's a natural and seemingly inevitable workload transition of our best teaching faculty towards the quest for enhanced scholarship, service responsibilities, or administrative duties. While there's every reason to believe that effective teaching and scholarship are mutually synergistic, the fact remains that our faculty often seek this reassigned time of their teaching workload to do scholarly activities, service responsibilities, or administration. Simply put, our best teaching faculty are also our best researchers and our best administrators. The redeployment of these highly effective teachers out of the classroom hurts us in the liberal arts. A second example kind of demonstrates a simple guns or butter sort of trade-off that occurs nearly as often. Our universities are given great authority in the allocation of faculty positions. It is natural for institutions to consider the pressing needs as well as return on investment of how best those faculty members ought to be deployed. It's natural for those for our institutions to be considering the professional fields as well as the liberal arts whenever they make these decisions. And the fact is, frankly, that there may be a greater return on investment if a faculty member is deployed in a professional field as opposed to a liberal arts field. Obviously, this undercuts the effectiveness of our liberal arts programs as well. This is compounded by grants and corporate partnerships, corporate contracts, and many of those occur in those professional and STEM disciplines as well. They're highly motivating prizes. Let me be clear. These decisions are normal and essential. We need great people to conduct life-changing research, and the need for faculty in the professional areas is really unquestioned and widely known. They are non-decisions if you look at them from that perspective. Institutions really don't have much choice when it comes to the deployment of high-quality faculty members in these areas. But it does have an impact on undergraduate liberal education. The second threat to a liberal arts education comes from competition within our own curriculum. Our students and faculty often characterize the foundational liberal arts as George Mahaffey and one of our Bart Hayes professors, Shayla Mills, calls the broccoli curriculum. And that is that faculty tell students that they must take general education classes because, quote unquote, they are good for you. They may not taste that good, but they're good for you. And that's essentially what the broccoli curriculum is. Advisors say we need to get you in this general education class so we can get it out of the way. So even in our own rhetoric, we reinforce that broccoli curriculum. This perception is amplified by the increasing demands within our own major programs. The historic tension is that general education is seen as less valuable than disciplinary classes. And this perception has only escalated since the recession of 2008. There's more pressure than ever for students to get degrees in workforce-ready professional areas like business, technology, teacher education, and nursing, and so on. Robert Thompson provides a national context in his recent AACNU article. He says, On the one hand, colleges and universities are being criticized for not engaging the quote-unquote big questions that involve ultimate values and standards, and there are calls to include moral, civic, and political development and preparation for reflective citizenship. On the other hand, colleges and universities are being called on to abandon their commitment to provide a broad liberal education and instead focus on connecting college education more directly to the needs of the economy. But higher education has added another layer to ratchet this tension even higher. For the last 40 years or so, it seems like every decade has been marked with a national du jour theme, which competes for those 120 credit hours that our students must take. For example, in the 1980s, it was diversity. In the 1990s, it was technology. In 2000, it was globalization. Today, STEM, undergraduate research, and interdisciplinary studies compete for that non-existent space as well. We then revise our liberal arts program offerings to encompass these themed approaches, which really means we're going to turn around and do this again in 10 more years whenever the next du jour themed approach comes out. Obviously, this complicates matters. Again, each of these situations are dictated by circumstances outside of the control of any of our institutions or even the system. Believe me, thoughtful, innovative solutions to solve these concerns, to solve these challenges, have been somewhat unsuccessful, but it's not for lack of knowledge or systematic trying within Kansas higher education systems. They're difficult challenges that everyone faces. And, of course, there are external threats to accomplishing the goals of liberal arts education. Part of the national and state discussion has rightly focused on student success, but equating student success with a four-year graduation rate is problematic, especially when you're talking about the liberal arts. Individual student differences and interests necessitate a broader view of student success. The Spellings Commission report was a shocking call to action for higher education, with a greater focus on access, affordability, quality, accountability, and innovation. Every institution is forced to face these demands, and liberal arts education is often the affected bystander. It should be no surprise to anybody that the goals and outcomes of liberal education have taken significant hits because of these. Nevertheless, every regioned institution still unequivocally extols the virtue of liberal arts education as essential to the next generation. Liberal education survives and advances because educators intrinsically understand that to abdicate those principles jeopardizes the integrity of our college degrees and our missions. Proposition 2. There are some unique and timely outcomes associated with strong liberal arts education that I think are especially relevant in 2014. This morning, you've heard several compelling arguments supporting liberal arts education. I want to take just a moment or two, though, and focus on what I consider to be unique and timely outcomes, which are especially relevant today. These objectives are embraced by every one of the region's institutions in one form or fashion. They may seem like they're common across all the institutions, and they bear no weight, but I think that is really an attribute of their significance as well. The first of these unique outcomes, civic engagement, really continues to excite our students and faculty alike. The national discussion of the deterioration of social and political communities has sparked a desire in higher education to assure that students are exposed to learning experiences that ensure their ability and interest to change their own communities. Peter Levine said that the purpose of liberal arts is to prepare people for responsible citizenship. And the best forms of civic engagement are intellectually challenging. They are liberal arts education in action or liberal arts learned and tested experientially. Liberal arts education makes people better workers, it promotes employment, and is the path to solving serious public problems. Liberal arts education allows people to facilitate discussions among themselves. It allows them to discuss, to share those ideas, and to learn from others. And that affects change at the community level. Regions have very much been forerunners in the area of civic investment and civic engagement, as has been evidenced by our involvement in the American Democracy Project, as well as the Carnegie Foundation Community Engagement Designation, which is held by several of your institutions. this singular outcome, it seems like to me, that of civic engagement, is one of the most important that we can point to out of our general education or liberal education programs and say that we're being successful in this area, especially for Kansas communities. The second of the unique and timely outcomes created through liberal arts education relates to the necessity of preparation for an increasingly global workplace. In a recent article, it was found that there's relatively uniform alignment between general education goals and globalization goals. Those outcomes are very, very similar, it's been found. More employers are seeking global competencies of knowledge of political and social economic global affairs, proficiency in writing and speaking with people from other cultures, intellectual and psychological flexibility to adapt to unfamiliar and rapidly changing circumstances. Notably, all of these are outcomes that you would expect out of a liberal arts education. The final liberal arts competency that I think your Regents institutions really assure you today really gets to the point of leadership and then the future leadership potential of the graduates. The CEO of the Seagreens Corporation that I mentioned earlier suggested that business leaders should be encouraging college-bound students to take a hard look at the liberal arts programs because it really does prepare them for a lifetime as opposed to just a technical that technical episode. He articulates a common misgiving. In our haste to get everyone capable technologically, we lose sight of creating well-rounded individuals who know how to do more than write computer programs. The dean at Grinnell College, Mark Peltz, said that liberal arts education may be a significant contributor to career success of leaders in business, government, and nonprofit sectors. Our nation's leaders need to be able to strategically think and plan, interpret global conditions, effectively marshal resources, and collaboratively guide people, groups of diverse people. Many would argue that effective communication, strategic analytic thinking, problem solving, and collaboration are essential elements for effective leadership, and notably, all of those are outcomes of a liberal arts education. My position is pretty simply summarized by saying that despite the threats facing liberal education, universities are still able to produce graduates that meet the technical and general competencies necessary for successful work, home, and civic life. But the unqualified support of policymakers for liberal education is essential in order to assure that Kansas universities can continue to impact communities in a very meaningful way. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Thank each of you. That's really very interesting. I've got a few questions, but I'm going to open up and see if my colleagues have some questions. So we're just going to have some Q&A for a bit here. So. Regent Logan.
So let's just tackle the jobs myth right off the bat. I'm looking at this data in here, and so the myth is, I'll use an example from our retreat last summer. A legislator said, "Well, you know, these philosophy majors don't get jobs," and then the governor's chief of staff said, "Well, hold on. I was a philosophy major." But I'm looking at the data here, and it seems to me that liberal arts degrees lead to jobs. That's what the data tell us. Is that am I reading that right?
Anybody can answer.
Anybody.
Yeah.
Well, not back there, Jim. We've got a panel up here for a reason. Surely somebody's going to tackle it. But then, Jim.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you should have a blue light there.
Okay,
yeah.
So I would say you're interpreting the data correctly. And the thing that is really interesting is that as you read through this, if you're a recent grad, as you're looking at your employment, there is a certain level that you achieve, and it is positive across the board. As you get more experience, the value of that degree goes up even more. And many individuals with undergraduate degrees in the humanities or the social sciences often go on for a graduate degree, and that makes a huge difference. And so this is an important platform that ensures career success.
It also seems to me, just looking at this, that the earnings data compares quite favorably for liberal arts graduates in the humanities, for instance. Median earnings, it looks like $51,000 versus $56,000. I mean, that compares very favorably. Am I reading it right?
You're reading it very right. The median salary of $56,000, looking across all majors, and then breaking it down specifically, the ones that individuals would think that are very low actually are quite close to that median, and they're doing much better than some of the public myths would lead people to think.
Is it okay for me to call on Jim Carruthers back? He wanted to add something. Go ahead, Jim.
Would you stand so we can
answer to your question? But I would like to be just very briefly answer it as an advocate for the study of modern foreign languages. If you wanted to pick a project for the teens following the completion of the STEM project, we might well recruit, encourage, support people who will learn to be genuinely fluent or move toward fluency in a modern foreign language. There is almost no employment inside or outside of the public or private sector that is not enhanced by knowledge of other languages, and we are deficient in producing those. Now, the ones who are doing that are employable in an amazing variety of contexts. Thank you.
Just to piggyback on what Jim Carruthers is saying, if you look at, dig in on the employment data and salary, if you have a double major and one of them is the foreign language and you can use that, the scale of your initial earnings goes up by about $10,000. One of the persons on my alumni advisory board was an undergraduate French major. And then she has an MBA. She works in international finance. She says that more than anything in her daily life, she uses her French undergraduate in her everyday interactions with all of her counterparts in Europe more than her knowledge from her MBA, and it makes a big difference.
Excuse me, just as a reminder, if you're going to speak, talk into the mic. I couldn't hear very much of the last comment.
Yeah, Mr. Crutch. Okay, so sorry about that, Regent Margie. We had an audience member, so we'll try to make sure they get to a mic. Regent Logan, you...
I'll hold for now.
Regent Van Etten.
Well, in my case, it would be the opposite. My native language is Chinese, so by learning English, that really give me the more opportunities advancing my study and in my career. And I want to also let you know I have a BA degree, too. So... And that itself is kind of like a glue to help me to fine-tune where my future skill I would like to earn or learn. And that is the critical thinking piece is so critical. It's not be able to obtain naturally. It will be have to go through this liberal arts study. So I generally believe in liberal arts as a very critical portion of the higher ed. Thank you.
Regent Logan, I'm glad you pointed out the salary, because I think that is I think it's something we all need to work on, because I think it is a myth that's out there that really needs to be put to rest. So, you know, we framed this – I want to frame the issue just a little bit because it come up at our retreat. So I think this is a great subject. And for me – this fits clearly under one of our strategic planks, and that's of excellence. And we think of excellence, and I'm going to make a statement or two, then I'll invite any of you to react. It would seem to me that it would be nearly impossible to have a great institution and not have great liberal arts curriculum. It's kind of the underpinning of everything else we do. Now, I'd invite you to comment on that, and then I think every one of you used the term liberal arts and general education, and it almost sounded like those were interchangeable. And it, is that right, wrong, or did I just not hear you correctly? Chancellor.
I think it's important to recall something that Danny said earlier, that when we're talking about liberal arts, we're talking about math and science as well. And so if you have that general view of it, then when we talk about general education, it includes studying from humanities, social sciences, math, and science, and having that broad perspective, so that in many ways the general education for students who are not liberal arts and sciences major is that's where they get their base and their introduction, and includes the full range. Okay.
I would add a comment. A phrase that I have come to see used in many contexts is talking about what is called the T-bone professional. And so if you just imagine the letter T and think about the top horizontal bar as representing the breadth of your knowledge, and the area that goes down the vertical axis of the T is the place where you're major, the place where you have very domain-specific knowledge. And in today's world, as you're looking at change and you're thinking about what we need to be able to do, an individual needs both of those. If you only have domain-specific knowledge that can get stale pretty fast, and you don't have that broad breadth to help you know how do you keep it updated, then you have a problem in thinking about how will this person adapt over the course of his or her life. But thinking broadly about the excellence question, I think there is no way you can have a comprehensive university that is absent the values, the experience, the knowledge that is shared through arts, humanities, and social sciences. One of the things that I think of in terms of the arts is that not all of us are going to become a professional artist, but we all see every day. And the more that we engage with the arts and learn to listen better, to see better, the way that the humanities help us imagine the interior lives of others, understand their motivations, the ways that social sciences help us pull together data, information, evidence, that is essential for having a well-rounded, educated, contributing, free citizen.
And I'd add to that certainly there are institutions of different types that have more or less focus on liberal arts and sciences, but for a comprehensive university, and especially I would say a university of our type at the University of Kansas, it is absolutely essential. Next year is the 150th anniversary of the university, and we're also having an accreditation site visit next year. And so I was reading our self-study.
In celebration of the 150 years.
Celebration, yeah. That's the only way to celebrate. And I was reading our self-study for the accreditation visit and was reminded that the specific description of the university was a place where students can come to study literature, the arts, and the sciences. And I think that that is very much a part of our universities. It's certainly very much a part of the University of Kansas, and we're committed to all of those fields.
So I want to ask you how you all think about this, because you hear countless times, oh, golly, I got to get my general ed classes out of the way. It's like it's one of those things I just have to do. Share a personal epiphany. I know this will come as a shock to many of you, but I was not necessarily a model student.
I'm speechless.
Region log, and I did not ask for any commentary. But I'm going through the classes, and I'm not having a very good time. But I'm doing what you got to do, and then I get to a philosophy class that I ended up having to take only because it was the only thing available, and in the time frame, and I did it, and actually to this day, still the greatest teacher I ever had, and it was just this wonder. That was the moment for me when it just changed everything else, and every other class I took after that was always different, and it just seems to me that there's a real marketing opportunity, and instead of general ed being perceived as these things I just have to check through, man, why don't more kids understand, man, that is your opportunity to really start to stretch and learn and discover new things. And it just seems to me that there's an opportunity there that's maybe not being seized. So how do you all think about that?
You know, I think that students will say, oh, I have to get gen ed out of the way because it's a requirement. But I believe the reaction to the courses that are part of gen ed is just as you describe. And so when I meet our students who've completed their degrees, they are just as likely to mention a philosophy course or a history course or an English course as the thing that changed their whole experience, even if they're not majoring in those fields. And so I think that excitement that you described is very common for students studying in the humanities and social sciences. Still, that continues to be the case.
I think you're actually quite fortunate in receiving that aha moment while you were still at the institution you were at. I think so many of our students would say they receive great benefit of that, you know, 2 years out from their graduation or 5 years out, and they are begin to put the pieces together at that point. You know, I'd say that you're probably an exception when it comes to that.
Well, I was many a little older, and I was pretty thick-headed. It took me a while to get there. Danny, did you?
I would just say I had a group of 24 alumni who were ranging in age from 35 to 65, and I asked them, what was the most important class you took as an undergraduate at KU? And these were people with a variety of fields, microbiologists, chemists. They were all very successful in their businesses, and the answer was 10 of them a history class, 9 of them it was a writing or literature class, 4 of them identified a social science class, and one person who is a public administration specialist said a microbiology class on pathogens. And so the real variety, and that was one of her required classes, thinking about contagions and infections and why that really applied to her interest in public administration.
I think, you know, just following on to that, you know, you read business executives sometimes had majors, I mean, frequently had majors in liberal arts, and they will comment about, you know, how much that helped them in their business leadership career. I mean, there's all kinds of anecdotes like that.
Dr. Tompkins.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, I thought it interesting that Kirk and Tony, our two engineers, were the ones that wanted to get your gen eds out of the way. So I thought that's what you're laughing. I think if that's students, if, no, but I, but no, it's a conversation we had in our home when our girls were growing up, which is it's lovely if you know what you want to do and you know you're going to be an engineer and this is what you're going to do. But for the vast majority of people, I think, I mean, I'm in my 50s. I still don't know what I want to do. So I think it's just a great background for people. I mean, I have a business degree, a BS in business, but I went to a small liberal arts school, and I think that's what makes you well-rounded. I also think that I was thinking about this while they were talking. Big Bang Theory, for any of you that watch that, is a great advertisement for the liberal arts education. Okay.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah. I'm done.
Dr. Tompkins.
Now, just do you think, I know I've only been out of the country a couple of times, but in both instances, the universities that I interacted with did not put an emphasis in this. It seemed to me that and I'm struck, Danny, when you were saying, you know, to be free. And so we've had this feeling in this country of freedom that you don't feel other places, and that all of a sudden this, it seems to me this has distinguished us in the world.
Yes.
This
yes.
emphasis of developing the mind for broadly, for citizenship, for participation, for understanding, for making good decisions and choices and so forth, that I didn't see in those other two experiences. Would I be correct in saying that's similar other places maybe? Or?
Yes, I think that is correct. And it's achieved in different ways some places. I think in some European countries, the understanding is that the high school education is going to be rigorous and include some of those things. And then when you go to college, you go into your major or field of study. In some places, there has been more of a focus on technical education. And in some of those places, the desire is to change their model to include the kind of more general introduction to variety of fields that we have, because the sense is that it leads to more creativity. So I think you are right. And we are, as we're having this discussion, I think most of us have a common understanding and appreciation of the value of these areas. And maybe the question for us is how we can better convey that in conversations about what is the value of these areas, why do we teach them, and what kind of message can we carry about those?
Yeah. I was just going to add sort of a detail. If you think about Asia, Singapore, they are specifically trying to build liberal arts institutions. The tradition of rote learning or tracking a person into a role that they're destined to play is not providing the creativity or the innovation that their societies need. And they are looking to the U.S. model specifically as a solution to try and really bring more innovation into their economies.
So, Chancellor, or anybody else, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I feel like that, too. We need to really find ways to lift this up, put some exposure on it. So is there anything that the board can do to help with that? I mean, you don't have to answer that today, but it would be, or if there's something that comes top of mind, I think I can speak for the board. If there was something that we could do, I think we'd be interested in entertaining that. So, Danny, you're going to get to leave, so you can kind of say whatever you like.
You've done a great thing by going on record with a report. I think having an open conversation and encouraging a public examination of data and information is crucial. Thinking about ways to help shape the conversation, it may have sounded like an indirect comment early on, but I do worry with our society that is so polarized around issues of liberal and conservative in politics, that does have an unnecessary and unjust perception in terms of the phrase liberal arts. And to try and help people remember that we share that goal of having people who are free to participate in society, and that liberation, that liberalization, being free from unnecessary regulation, which is something that I think goes across many different political lines, is at the core of liberal arts education. We need people to be creative, and this is one of the places where we can truly make that happen in our society.
Further questions? Any comments from anybody other than the panel? Most of our present. Okay. Well, I want to take a moment and thank our panelists. You all kind of got this as other duties as assigned, but certainly appreciate you all. I know you put quite a bit of time into this, so on behalf of the board, we want to thank you for what you've done. I would tell you that I think this is a really important part of what we do as regents. So as we continue to move on, if any of you have ideas how we can continue to put some exposure, how we can educate, lift this up, we would entertain that. So let's call this the start of this conversation. And if there's opportunities to continue to advance it, we want to do that. But thank each and every one of you for what you provided us here today. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, so we will return at 10:35.
Mr. Chairman, I should have introduced this person earlier, so if you could indulge me just for a little bit. Good friend and the chief academic officer from Dodge City Community College is here, Danny Gillum, and I just wanted to welcome Danny.
Hey, Danny.
Welcome.
All right.